Final case today is case number 69210, In Re Parental Rights as to MML Jr. Mr. Grigsby for the appellate, Ms. Richter for the respondent. Welcome to both of you. Mr. Grigsby, did you want to save some time, for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I can reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
4 minutes, I'll try to keep an eye on the clock.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
May I please record? This involved a termination of parental rights action that was initiated by the Department of Family Services, represented by the Clark County District Attorney's Office. And this is a matter that, unfortunately, has something that happens all too common in these TPR proceedings that the department initiated. But the first step, service of process, wasn't properly done.
When was that ever contested throughout any of these proceedings? And why wasn't it waived?
Although I wasn't the trial counsel on this, I just came in as appellate counsel.
Right.
When I reviewed the record, I couldn't see whether it was specifically contested, although Judge Sullivan did make findings of having subject matter and personal jurisdiction. Although I would contend that this was an instance of fraud, not just failing to properly effectuate service. The department actually committed fraud upon the court.
And that was presented to the district court?
That wasn't presented to the district court. I don't think it was discovered until. And that's one of the problems you run into when you have a litigant that's not competent.
Was there a 60B motion to set anything aside based on fraud?
When I was brought in as appellate counsel, I had a very limited time either to file a notice of appeal or to do a 60B motion and do the toll thing. And since the 60B doesn't automatically toll, I made the decision to go with this to overall protect Ms. Peterson's rights.
Can I answer my question?
Yes. So what happens, the petition's filed on May 22nd, 2014. The very next day, an affidavit and request for publication is filed. And the district court granted the order for publication on June 2nd, approximately a week or so later. They granted the order for publication, and Mr. Peterson was served on publication. And reviewing the record from the evidentiary hearing, it's clear that at the time the petition was filed, there was a companion criminal case going on, which it was prosecuted by the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and Ms. Peterson was at Lakes Crossings at that time. And I was submitted to the, since the...
How long after this case was filed were the criminal charges filed?
Criminal charges were filed before the TPR.
Okay.
That's my understanding. And the testimony at the evidentiary hearing was that the department was on notice that she was at Lakes Crossings. And she was at Lakes Crossing throughout this entire time. With a couple of times she came back to CCDC, had briefly been restored to competency, then was sent back to Lakes Crossings again later in the criminal case, in the criminal proceeding. Given the fact that the same office was prosecuting both cases, and they're just one law firm, even though they have separate divisions, they were on notice that where she was at and should not have applied for a service by publication. And I don't believe there was anything that prohibited them from actually accomplishing service by proper service. They knew where she was at, she was in the state's care and custody, and it was easily been effectuated. And I understood this is the kind of fraud that would even fall under the 60B savings clause. But given the time constraints I was under when I was appointed to the appeal, this would have brought it forward here. And unfortunately, this isn't an isolated incident. This kind of happens repeatedly in TPR cases where they file the same affidavit for publication. I believe I have another matter for the court with a similar issue. So we have to have the good faith attempt at service that's required. And I would contend that on some level that may render the judgment void. because we don't have this good faith attempt at service. And in the answering brief, there was no explanation for why there was, why publication was requested one day after the petition being filed. So there was definitely the due diligence that this court has repeatedly held prior before a service by publication. And given that, as I say, this is fraught upon the court, that this is the type of procedural error that, given the severity of a TPR case, that should not be overlooked. And it violates the fundamental due process rights of Ms. Peterson, because publishing, and I'm not even sure if they allow access to newspapers, media, and Lakes Crossing. As an institution, but that's not the kind of notice that would be reasonably calculated to put on notice that, you know, that something was an issue and she needs to write. Now,
should we have different rules of competency for criminal cases as opposed to termination of parental rights? In other words, if somebody's found not competent to stand trial, should that stop everything in their lives and everything in their children's lives?
Actually, what I would contend is not that we need different rules, but there should have been a separate, because other states have dealt with this, for example, Michigan, holds a separate competency hearing for the TPR matter. And in that separate competency hearing, what could have been determined is whether there was a need, whether she could restore the competency in a reasonable amount of time.
But isn't that what you're talking about, the law in another state, a matter for the legislature?
I would say it's a, since we don't have any clear law one way or the other regarding incompetency in TPR proceedings.
Oh, we consider TPR, though, even though the punishment may be close to criminal, it's still a civil proceeding.
Yes, and as a civil proceeding.
And in this case, we have an attorney, we have a guardian ad litem that's been appointed.
Yes.
No objection was raised.
Well, I actually said both the attorney and the guardian ad litem both raised objections going forward, requested continuances because their client couldn't assist them, and I don't believe, if I remember the record correctly, the guardian ad litem hadn't had any contact with Ms. Peterson.
The record, at least the partial record we have, indicates that a number of continuances were granted, and Nevada and case authority has terminated what they call mentally challenged parents previously.
Yes, and I'm not contending that you can never terminate a mentally challenged person or someone who's rendered incompetent. I think we addressed that the proper test was the Matthews versus Eldridge test. I think both sides agree on that. But our contention is that the district court didn't do that test. I believe the state's answering, their answering brief, they say, well, it doesn't matter because it would come out the same way anyway. And we don't know how it would have come out, especially the kind of the third part of that test. We don't know, about the risk of erroneous deprivation of a protected interest, because the record's devoid of the district court making any analysis of any of this. At least from my view of the record, it appears that the district court essentially went on the time the subject matter had been in care and that was in the best interest for finality. And I would say that's just not the right test. And that's not what they should have done in this case. If they went through the right test, or even, as I contend, some other cases, it held a competency hearing, they may have determined, okay, she can be come back to competence with medication and she just refused to take it. Or there would maybe some expert testimony. And although this may have taken a bit longer, I believe it would have lent itself to a more accurate result, which is the ultimate goal of all this, not just the speed of the process, but coming to the right result. And which is why we needed something more than just to appoint a guardian ad litem who's never had any contact with the person, the person can't assist the guardian ad litem. I believe Oregon's dealt with similar cases in that respect and has found that essentially it could still be that risk of erroneous deprivation even for guardian ad litem's appointed if the litigant can't adequately assist them.
So let me ask you this. If that's the case, Why couldn't you make the argument if the parent can't assist during trial, why couldn't you also be unfit to continue it as serving as a parent?
Because if she can't assist during trial, we don't know whether she, for example, she may have been able to be restored to competency if she was provided medication.
Well, then she should be able to assist during trial.
But we don't know this. We don't know this, and that's why we say ultimately we need the competency, actual competency hearing, because then the record would reflect whether, you know, this is a chronic systemic situation, or she could be restored to competency with medication, but she's refusing to take the medication. That all lends itself to a more accurate result than, hey, she's mentally challenged, she can't assist her attorney, so then she can't parent, so let's terminate her parental rights. I think we missed the important steps in the middle. If she's restored to competency today, she may have no idea that her rights have been terminated or why, especially this instance because of the way service was effectuated and the fact that she was not part of these proceedings.
I have one more question that I'm just unclear on, and I wasn't sure from reading through all the materials. There's an indication that the mother didn't contest the merits of the district court's decision to terminate the parental rights. I don't understand that. Can you explain that to me?
I didn't get that the mother doesn't contest the merits of it, that they were proper in doing it.
Service and jurisdiction?
Well, if it was effective service, they didn't have jurisdiction, and they didn't go through the proper test. We're saying they should have never gone forward. They should have granted the continuance and then subsequently held either a competency hearing or some other measures to make sure that her constitutional interest right to parent was adequately protected, given the fact that, you know, she was incompetent to pursue, well, at least by the criminal court. We don't know all the rest of this information because it's not part of the record in this case. And like I said, the reason they kept setting it and unsetting it, from my understanding, just reading the record, is at some point she did come back to CCDC. She was back there at the time I was appointed to this matter, and then she was subsequently sent back to Lakes Crossing again. So we don't have those facts as part of this case, and I think that's something that, honestly, we need as part of the record to decide whether this termination was proper. That's why we ask that this matter be remanded, not only for consideration whether the fraud was effectuated and there was proper service, but also to serving for the proceedings to comply with Matthews versus Eldridge. Because if they did that, then we would at least have some more information, as opposed to appointing a guardian ad litem who's had no contact with the person. What if the guardian ad litem had decided, I'm going to, you know, since I'm in charge of this person, I'm just going to stipulate to relinquish the parental rights?
You have less than the 4 minutes. You have about two minutes.
If I can ask one question for the system. You mentioned the magic words, constitutional rights. Can you at least amplify what constitutional rights this person would have that we might be able to hang a hat on, since we have not done that in a civil context? Can you amplify why this is different to give us something that we might be able to work with?
What constitutional rights were at stake in this hearing?
That we should look at the competency issue.
Yes. The right to parent, which is 5B, you know, fundamental constitutional protected interest, and back to Stanley versus Illinois, that right to parent is what was at stake in this, is what Ms. Peterson lost. And the fact that she lost this right to parent without proper notice and without having a chance to appear and at least offer evidence or assist with her defense, to just terminate her rights, those constitutionally protected interests for her and for the child in her relationship with Ms. Peterson, without following the due process protections that are designed to protect the individual from the massive power of the state. I think that's the interest that we're dealing with here. And we have the system set up of these procedural safeguards, and we didn't follow them in this case. I guess I'd like to reserve whatever time I have for it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ricker.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice. Justices, may it please the court. My name is Stephanie Richter, and I represent the Department of Family Services for Clark County. In this case, the court properly weighed the competing constitutional interests. There's a constitutional interest of the parent to be able to parent the child. There's also an interest of this child to be able to have a permanent fit parent to provide care for them. In this case, I just want to go over some of the facts. The child was removed on January 24th of 2013. The mother pled no contest to the petition in February of 2013. The case plan originates from March 7th of 2013. The TPR was filed in May 22nd of 2014, and on August 13th of 2014, there was an initial TPR hearing wherein Ms. Peterson's attorney appeared, requested the matter was set for trial, and requested a guardian ad litem for the mother. There was a multiple continuances in this case, and I'd encourage the court to look at the minutes. Based on the minutes, and I direct your attention to page Respondent's Appendix 143, the guardian ad litem did have contact with the mother. There's a specific note that he had last had communication with the mother 10 days ago, and she was lucid at that time. I think from the record, we can conclude that both the attorney and the guardian ad litem were in contact with the mother throughout this case, which would be a responsible attorney. With regards to this case, the trial didn't occur until September 10th of 2015. The court gave continuances for more than a year to attempt to make this parent competent. The parent was unable to be made competent. If we look at the Nevada statutes, NRS provides that you can consider mental illness in unfitness or neglect. The mother's mental illness is put in evidence in this case in the fact that the competency documents were provided to the court as evidence at the TPR trial. So the court did have the mental health records from Lakes Crossing to consider to determine that she was mentally unfit to provide care for her child. And the court ultimately
did. But were those competency determinations that she was unfit to assist in her defense in the criminal trial, or were they that she was unfit to care for the child?
It was that she was unfit to proceed in the criminal trial, which I think based on what was entered into evidence is relevant to her fitness to be a parent. If she's unfit to recognize the charges against her, and in this case they deemed her a danger to herself and society, she would be unfit to care for her child.
Right, but I just want to be clear, the determination of lack of competence was
It was only in the criminal case.
Yes, so there was no separate determination. I think this is Mr. Grigsby's point, that she was incompetent to assist in the defense of whether her parental rights should be terminated or she should have a guardian appointed or that she was unfit to be a mother, that those were different issues that she deserved a separate hearing on. I think that's his point.
Well, the attorney for her never requested a separate competency hearing. He appeared at court multiple times to update the court as to what was going on in her criminal competency hearing and used that as the basis to say that she was incompetent to assist him at trial. So I don't know that they can necessarily be separated.
So that attorney never raised the issue of competency as far as termination of parental rights?
Correct.
So he waived it?
Correct. That would be my contention. And if we look at this, the court attempted to give the mother due process. They gave the mother a guardian ad litem to protect her interests. He continued the case for over a year to allow her time to attempt to become competent. At a certain point, this court then looked at, I have to weigh the competing interest of this child to permanency, the child's in an adoptive home, the child's been in care for approximately two years, 9 months, we need to proceed on this case versus can the mother be made competent in a reliable period of time.
What services did the department attempt to provide for the mother in an attempt for her to regain competency?
Well, the mother was referred to mental health counseling. She was actually involved in mental health counseling at one point in her case, and she opted to end that counseling. They re-referred her to mental health counseling multiple other times, got her involved with Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health, and ultimately their attempts kind of came to an end when she was arrested for her criminal charges of kidnapping, first-degree kidnapping and first-degree child abuse, in which she tried to take another child off of the city bus, thinking it was hers, because the child was allegedly talking to her and attempting to kidnap that child. From that point on, she was in custody.
I'm concerned because as we play with this term competency, if she was deemed incompetent from a criminal standpoint, the department is asking her to make certain rational choices and decisions that if she's not competent, has no understanding from a criminal standpoint, it's kind of hard to bleed over and say she can follow this case plan and make rational decisions. And that's why I'm asking, what did the department do to at least attempt to assist her in efforts to become competent, to see whether or not in a reasonable period of time she could become, quote, not mentally challenged to be a fit parent?
Until she was arrested, I think the department believed, the worker believed that she was competent. The worker was able to have lucid conversations with her. The worker was able to refer to mental health, have conversations about her medication. At one point, she was medication compliant, and then she became not medication compliant. I think if we look at this mother's history, though, as the district court did, there's years of issues of her being competent and having her mental health under control, and then being reintroduced to a psychiatric hospital, having multiple hospitalizations since even her case originated in 2015 with the Department of Family Services. But she had an excellent caseworker who attempted to follow up with her at every step to maintain contact with her and attempted to get her into services. And I think if you look at the record, at certain points the mother is competent and she is following along with her case plan and shows that she could possibly do this if she was to manage her mental illness. But at this point, 2 years and 9 months in, the court found that she hadn't managed her mental illness and that she was unfit on that basis.
Do certain presumptions come into play because the child was in foster care over a lengthy period of time?
Certain presumptions do come into play, specifically best interest. The court also applied failure of parental adjustment and other presumptions and applied those and said, absent those presumptions, I would still find that there was unfitness. So the presumptions do apply, but separate from that, there is a factual finding that I would make that she is unfit as well without the presumptions.
Ms. Richter, the initial part of Mr. Grigsby's argument was that the affidavit supporting service by publication amounted to a fraud upon the court. What is your response to that, and what specifically did the affidavit say? And did not the division know of the location of Misty?
Misty Peterson was arrested around the time that the petition was filed. Mm-hmm. The affidavits of service are typically filed immediately in our cases because, as I'm sure you're aware, oftentimes parents cannot be found in termination of parental rights cases with the Department of Family Services. In this case, it provided her last known address, all the required information to get a order of publication, and the court ultimately gave an order of publication. With that, we did attempt to serve Ms. Peterson. There was an affidavit of attempted service filed. I believe that service was properly done in this court, but more importantly, I believed it was waived because it was not raised below.
Didn't she enter a general appearance in the...
She entered an appearance through her attorney. Her attorney appeared at multiple hearings, never raised the issue of service. We went through an entire trial, and it's being raised for the first time on appeal.
But an assertion that the affidavit was a fraud upon the court is a different argument than whether or not service by publication was waived. Did the division initiate service by publication, yet knowing her location was different than her former residence?
Our office did not initiate service by publication knowing that. Where we request a service, an affidavit for, or we do an affidavit of service by publication typically in every case. We attempt to personally serve all parents in every case. In doing so, we attempt to locate and do a diligent search on all parents. If she had been incarcerated at the time that service was attempted on her, that would have been found by that, by our diligent search and by a custody search, and she would have attempted to have been served at the place that she was located. We routinely serve people at CCDC, Nevada Department of Corrections, Las Vegas City Jail.
My understanding is that she was either incarcerated at CCDC.
I believe she was at CCDC at the time.
Right.
And I believe that she was actually served there.
You say she was served there?
I'd have to look
at the attempted service was at her former residence. That's what our information is.
I'd have to look at the record as to when they knew that she was at CCDC. But My understanding is she would have been served at the last known address that we had or her custody location on the date that we served.
Let's see, the concern is when you say you use due diligence to attempt to find her, she's in the criminal justice system. And normally a server would look at those systems. That's just a concern.
And our servers do look at those systems. They do custody searches, and they do...
I understand that's the standard practice or the intended standard practice. What happens if it doesn't happen? What happens if it didn't happen in this case? Is the representation to the court tantamount to a fraud upon the court about the service efforts?
I don't believe so. I believe that we made the best effort to serve her at the location that we knew her to be at the time. All of our attorneys who do the termination hearings, we do custody searches before we go to court so that we don't proceed against any parents who are incarcerated. Our office makes the best effort to make sure that all parents are appropriately served if we can locate them.
Well, do you agree with counsel that at the time the affidavit was tendered to the court, she was incarcerated at CCDC?
I would have to look at the exact date that she was there. The issue we might have is that when a parent is incarcerated at CCDC and they're sent to Lakes Crossing, they no longer appear in the CCDC system for service. So she may very well have been at Lakes Crossing when they did the search, and it doesn't appear that she was in custody.
Would they not, though, appear in the criminal records if they ran her name?
It wouldn't say that she was at Lakes Crossing. We don't have access to the criminal depository.
Would it show that she, in fact, had an active case?
We do not have we can pull the criminal records that are on file in Odyssey. Our attorneys typically do that. I don't know that our process servers look at whether there's an active criminal case and whether a parent may be at Lakes Crossing. They look at all the inmate locators that we have in the state to determine if a parent's in custody.
That brings into question the due diligence that was in fact used. You start explaining it away. Because at one point you say, we did everything we were supposed to do, and then you say, well, we only did this.
Why didn't the attorney raise it, though? Why didn't her attorney raise it?
I do not know why her attorney did not raise that issue, and I believe it was waived. They went through a complete trial on the merits in this case, and now wish to contest it.
Was the guardian there also, her guardian there?
The guardian was there.
Did the guardian say anything to the judge about, by the way, she wasn't served or something?
No, the guardian said, I'm not prepared to proceed. I don't feel that I can proceed without her here to assist me. And then the judge weighed the factors as to whether we should go forward or not and made a determination to proceed. But neither the guardian or the mother raised the issue. The mother's attorney raised the issue of service. And they both had contact throughout their case with the mother at times when she was lucid, which would indicate that she knew that the termination proceeding was going on and was communicating with and attempting to assist her attorneys.
Did you try to bring her to the hearing?
At one point, if you look at the minutes, she was attempted to be brought while she was at CC to the hearing. CCDC, there was a transport order filed. For whatever reason, she was not transported. When we inquired about transferring from Lakes Crossing, they do not transport from Lakes Crossing for family court matters.
Any other issues? Thank you very much. Mr. Grigsby, let me round you off to about 2 minutes. Give him about 2 minutes.
And to sort of answer some of the questions that were asked of Ms. Richter, yes, the court system will show that if someone has an active criminal case, you can actually, in ordinary systems, just look that up online, and the minutes for those cases will show whether the person was transferred to Lakes Crossing. It's usually a minute order that's entered in every district court case and whether they're transferred, either whether they're sent to Lakes Crossing or whether the case has been transferred to the special judge that normally set up to handle the competency matters in the 8th Judicial District Court. I believe one of the things that's really important is for the due diligence on the service is they said they filed an affidavit for publication in every case. And in this case, it was filed the day after the petition was filed. And being filed one day later, you can't have done the due diligence that our case is required. And this, of course, as I said repeatedly, is required. And given the fact that it was an active criminal case, and the criminal case is being prosecuted by the same office that's representing the department and the termination of criminal rights case, I believe that we can, they're deemed to know that this. I'm not sure how their case management system works in their office, but they're all still one law firm, and they're all one law firm for conflict issues, two one law firm for no, for deciding whether they knew whether she was in custody or not, and they have the obligation.
So this wasn't like a default. In other words, the attorney's there, the guardian's there, and they go through a whole trial. So it wasn't like a default.
It wasn't like a default, but the court doesn't acquire that initial jurisdiction given the fraudulent service. Now, I can't answer why the trial attorney or the guardian litem didn't raise this issue. I said that wasn't me at the time.
Did they raise anything as to the competency issue other than the party being sent to Lakes Crossing? Did they come in with their own affidavits from a psychologist saying that they're not competent to assist?
None of those affidavits were admitted. Essentially, what the court did is it took the J file and into J file, and then there was the state and some other records from the criminal case, and which is why I was saying that the separate competency issue here is needing these TPR cases so that we have a complete record, because even from what they're saying is she had been restored at some periods through medication and then was not competent through other periods. Then that's a different issue than whether she can never be restored to competency. And we don't know which one it is because we didn't have a separate competency issue hearing, and the record's devoid of those facts.
How do you reconcile that, out of curiosity? You're waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for this individual to become competent. She comes in and out of competency. This could go on for years. At what point does the policy of establishing permanency for the child trump this waiting period?
And that's where the Matthews versus Eldridge test come in.
And even though the district court didn't specifically point to Matthews, that clearly, in looking through the district court order, those considerations were made.
I guess I see when I went through the transcripts and the order, the thing I saw that the district court really considered, the judge something really considered, was the amount of time the child had been in the care and the need for finality. Those were the two things that the overriding concerns that I saw all throughout the transcripts of the various hearings and of the order. The order does have some form language in there, but that's what I saw as the overriding concern, which is the amount of time this child has been in secure and we need to get finality, and not the other factors, and especially the risk of erroneously depriving some of their parental rights, especially given the competency situation. I think that we have those procedural safeguards are the utmost important in these termination of parental rights cases, and we just can't give them lip service. We have to go through all the factors and all the steps for each one of these cases, even though it may not result in the speediest resolution, it will help us become comfortable that we've reached the accurate and correct resolution for the case.
In the state that you found that required competency, was that based upon their state constitution, or was that a legislative fiat?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Was the competency requirement, I guess it was of Michigan, that you mentioned earlier, was that based upon the state constitution, or was that a legislative determination?
Actually, it was based on the U.S. Constitution. Actually, Michigan didn't have a separate. They were in the same position we are now, where this was their case of first impression. They didn't have a separate statutory scheme to deal with this at the time. And they went through some of the same considerations that we've both been throwing out back and forth, and came up with the fact that, hey, we at least need a competency hearing, a separate competency hearing in the TPR case, so we can decide if this hearing they're expecting to have, especially if the attorney says that they don't think the client's competent, then the hearing's mandatory, or this court can respond to order one, and the kind of thing, they address some of the things they kind of want to see. For example, expert testimony regarding whether the person can be restored to competency or not, And that's kind of what we're lacking here. Some of the things I think this court's struggling with and the questions you're asking is based on the things that we may have, that we would probably have if we had had a separate competency hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Grigsby.
Thank you.
I want to thank Ms. Richter and Mr. Grigsby for your fine arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted and we're in recess until the next.